Chapter 28. Goodbye. She waved her hand and was gone. She's right. I won't go, he murmured. He passed the evening and following days in mortifying by every possible means his wish to see her, nearly starving himself in attempts to extinguish, by fasting, his passionate tendency to love her. He read sermons on discipline, and hunted up passages in church history that treated of the ascetics of the second century. Before he had returned from Mary Green to Melchester, there arrived a letter from Arabella. The sight of it revived a stronger feeling of self-condemnation for his brief return to her society than for his attachment to Sue. The letter, he perceived, bore a London postmark instead of the Christminster one. Arabella informed him that a few days after their parting in the morning at Christminster, as he had been surprised by an affectionate letter from her Australian husband, formerly manager of the hotel in Sydney. He had come to England on purpose to find her, and had taken a free, fully licensed public in Lambeth, where he wished her to join him in conducting the business, which was likely to be a very thriving one, the house being situated in an excellent, densely populated, gin-drinking neighborhood, and already doing a trade of £200 a month, which could be easily doubled. As he had said, that he loved her very much still, and implored her to tell him where she was, and as they had only parted in a slight tiff, and as her engagement in Christminster was only temporary, as he had just gone to join him as he urged, she could not help feeling that she belonged to him more than to Jude, since as he had properly married him, and had lived with him much longer than with her first husband. In thus wishing Jude goodbye, she bore him no ill will, and trusted he would not turn upon her, a weak woman, and inform against her, and bring her to ruin now that she had a chance of improving her circumstances and leading a genteel life. Jude returned to Melchester, which had the questionable recommendation of being only a dozen and a half miles from his Sue's now permanent residence. At first he felt that this nearness was a distinct reason for not going southward at all, but Christminster was too sad a place to bear, while the proximity of Shaston to Melchester might afford him the glory of worsting the enemy in a close engagement, such as was deliberately sought by the priests and virgins of the early church, who, disdaining an ignominious flight from temptation, became even chamber partners with impunity. Jude did not pause to remember that, in the laconic words of the historian, insulted nature sometimes vindicated her rights in such circumstances. He now returned with feverish desperation to his study for the priesthood and the recognition that the single-mindedness of his aims, and his fidelity to the cause, had been more than questionable of late. His passion for Sue troubled his soul. Yet his lawful abandonment to the society of Arabella for 12 hours seemed instinctively a worse thing, even though as he had not told him of her Sydney husband till afterwards. He had, he verily believed, overcome all tendency to fly to liquor which, indeed, he had never done from taste, but merely as an escape from intolerable misery of mind. Yet he perceived with despondency that, taken all round, he was a man of too many passions to make a good clergyman. The utmost he could hope for was that in a life of constant internal warfare between flesh and spirit the former might not always be victorious. As a hobby, auxiliary to his readings in divinity, he developed his slight skill in church music and thorough bass, till he could join in part singing from notation with some accuracy. A mile or two from Melchester there was a restored village church, to which Jude had originally gone to fix the new columns and capitals. By this means he had become acquainted with the organist, and the ultimate result was that he joined the choir as a bass voice. He walked out to this parish twice every Sunday, and sometimes in the week. One evening about Easter the choir met for practice, and a new hymn which Jude had heard of as being by a Wessex composer was to be tried and prepared for the following week. It turned out to be a strangely emotional composition. As they all sang it over and over again, its harmonies grew upon Jude, and moved him exceedingly. When they had finished, he went round to the organist to make inquiries. The score was in manuscript, the name of the composer being at the head, together with the title of the hymn, "He Foot of the Cross." "Yes," said the organist. "He is a local man. He is a professional musician at Kennet Bridge between here and Christminster. The vicar knows him. He was brought up and educated in Christminster traditions, which accounts for the quality of the piece. I think he plays in the large church there, and has a surplus choir. He comes to Melchester sometimes, and once tried to get the cathedral organ, when the post was vacant. The hymn is getting about everywhere this Easter." As he walked humming the air on his way home, Jude fell to musing on its composer, and the reasons why he composed it. What a man of sympathies he must be! Perplexed and harassed as he himself was about Sue and Arabella, and troubled as was his conscience by the complication of his position, how he would like to know that man! "He of all men would understand my difficulties," said the impulsive Jude. "If there were any person in the world to choose as a confidant, this composer would be the one, for he must have suffered, and throbbed, and yearned." In brief, ill as he could afford the time and money for the journey, Folly resolved, like the child that he was, to go to Kennet Bridge the very next Sunday. He duly started, early in the morning, for it was only by a series of crooked railways that he could get to the town. About midday he reached it, and crossing the bridge into the quaint old borough, he inquired for the house of the composer. They told him it was a red brick building some little way further on. Also that the gentleman himself had just passed along the street not 5 minutes before. "Which way?" asked Jude with alacrity. "Straight along homeward from church." Jude hastened on, and soon had the pleasure of observing a man in a black coat and a black slouched felt hat no considerable distance ahead. Stretching out his legs, yet more widely he stalked after. "Hungry soul in pursuit of a full soul," he said. "Must speak to that man." He could not, however, overtake the musician before he had entered his own house, and then arose the question if this were an expedient time to call. Whether or not he decided to do so there and then, now that he had got here, the distance home being too great for him to wait till late in the afternoon. This man of soul would understand scant ceremony, and might be quite a perfect adviser in a case in which an earthly and illegitimate passion had cunningly obtained entrance into his heart through the opening afforded for religion. Jude accordingly rang the bell, and was admitted. The musician came to him in a moment, and being respectably dressed, good-looking, and frank in manner, Jude obtained a favorable reception. He was nevertheless conscious that there would be a certain awkwardness in explaining his errand. "I have been singing in the choir of a little church near Melchester," he said. "And we have this week practiced the foot of the cross, apostrophe which I understand, sir, that you composed?" "I did a year or so ago. I like it. I think it supremely beautiful."
"Ah, well, other people have said so too."
"Yes, there's money in it, if I could only see about getting it published. I have other compositions to go with it too. I wish I could bring them out, for I haven't made a £5 note out of any of them yet. These publishing people, they want the copyright of an obscure composer's work, such as mine is, for almost less than I should have to pay a person for making a fair manuscript copy of the score. The one you speak of I have lent to various friends about here and Melchester, and so it has got to be sung a little. But music is a poor staff to lean on. I am giving it up entirely. You must go into trade if you want to make money nowadays. The wine business is what I am thinking of. This is my forthcoming list. It is not issued yet, but you can take one." He handed Jude an advertisement list of several pages in booklet shape, ornamentally margined with a red line, in which were set forth the various clarets, champagnes,
ports, sherries, and other wines with which he purposed to initiate his new venture. It took Jude more than by surprise that the man with the soul was thus and thus, and he felt that he could not open up his confidences. They talked a little longer, but constrainedly, for when the musician found that Jude was a poor man, his manner changed from what it had been while Jude's appearance and address deceived him as to his position and pursuits. Jude stammered out something about his feelings in wishing to congratulate the author on such an exalted composition, and took an embarrassed leave. All the way home by the slow Sunday train, sitting in the fireless waiting rooms on this cold spring day, he was depressed enough at his simplicity in taking such a journey. But no sooner did he reach his Melchester lodging than he found awaiting him a letter which had arrived that morning a few minutes after he had left the house. It was a contrite little note from Sue, in which she said, with sweet humility, that she felt as he had been horrid in telling him he was not to come to see her, that she despised herself for having been so conventional, and that he was to be sure to come by the 11:45 train that very Sunday, and have dinner with them at 1:30. Jude almost tore his hair at having missed this letter till it was too late to act upon its contents. But he had chastened himself considerably of late, and at last his chimerical expedition to Kennetbridge really did seem to have been another special intervention of Providence, to keep him away from temptation. But a growing impatience of faith, which he had noticed in himself more than once of late, made him pass over in ridicule the idea that God sent people on fool's errands. He longed to see her, he was angry at having missed her. And he wrote instantly, telling her what had happened, and saying he had not enough patience to wait till the following Sunday, but would come any day in the week that she liked to name. Since he wrote a little over ardently, Sue, as her manner was, delayed her reply till Thursday before Good Friday, when she said he might come that afternoon if he wished, this being the earliest day on which she could welcome him, for she was now assistant teacher in her husband's school. Jude therefore got leave from the cathedral works at the trifling expense of a stoppage of pay, and went. Part 4th, at Shaston, Woso prefers either matrimony or other ordinance before the good of man, and the plain exigence of charity, let him profess Papist, or Protestant, or what he will, he is no better than a Pharisee. J. Milton. I, Shaston, the ancient British palliter, from whose foundation first such strange reports arise, as Drayton sang it, was, and is, in itself the city of a dream. Vague imaginings of its castle, its three mints, its magnificent apsidal abbey, the chief glory of South Wessex, its 12 churches, its shrines, chantries, hospitals, its gabled freestone mansions all now ruthlessly swept away through the visitor, even against his will, into a pensive melancholy, which the stimulating atmosphere and limitless landscape around him can scarcely dispel. The spot was the burial place of a king and a queen, of abbots and abbesses, saints and bishops, knights and squires. The bones of King Edward, the martyr, carefully removed hither for holy preservation, brought Shaston a renown which made it the resort of pilgrims from every part of Europe, and enabled it to maintain a reputation extending far beyond English shores. To this fair creation of the great Middle Age the dissolution was, as historians tell us, the death knell. With the destruction of the enormous abbey the whole place collapsed in a general ruin. The martyr's bones met with the fate of the sacred pile that held them, and not a stone is now left to tell where they lie. The natural picturesqueness and singularity of the town still remain, but strange to say these qualities, which were noted by many writers in ages, when scenic beauty is said to have been unappreciated, are passed over in this, and one of the queerest and quaintest spots in England stands virtually unvisited today. It has a unique position on the summit of a steep and imposing scarp, rising on the north, south, and west sides of the borough out of the deep alluvial vale of Blackmoor, the view from the castle green over three counties of verdant pasture south, Mid, and Nether Wessex being as sudden a surprise to the unexpected traveler's eyes as the medicinal air is to his lungs. Impossible to a railway, it can best be reached on foot, next best by light vehicles, and it is hardly accessible to these, but by a sort of isthmus on the northeast, that connects it with the high chalk tableland on that side. Such is, and such was, the now world-forgotten Shastinner Palliter. Its situation rendered water the great want of the town, and within living memory, horses, donkeys, and men may have been seen toiling up the winding ways to the top of the height, laden with tubs and barrels filled from the wells beneath the mountain, and hawkers retailing their contents at the price of a halfpenny a bucketful. This difficulty in the water supply, together with two other odd facts, namely, that the chief graveyard slopes up as steeply as a roof behind the church, and that in former times the town passed through a curious period of corruption, conventual and domestic, gave rise to the saying that Shaston was remarkable for three consolations to man, such as the world afforded not elsewhere. It was a place where the churchyard lay nearer heaven than the church steeple, where beer was more plentiful than water, and where there were more wanton women than honest wives and maids. It is also said that after the Middle Ages the inhabitants were too poor to pay their priests, and hence were compelled to pull down their churches, and refrain altogether from the public worship of God. A necessity which they bemoaned over their cups in the settles of their inns on Sunday afternoons. In those days the Shastonians were apparently not without a sense of humor. There was another peculiarity, this a modern one, which Shaston appeared to owe to its site. It was the resting place and headquarters of the proprietors of wandering vans, shows, shooting galleries, and other Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.